Well, hello again, dear reader and dear listener, and welcome to Episode 7 of the Handsome Timidity Express. The Handsome Timidity Express is proud to be a part of the Dan and Travis podcast on iTunes and The Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that attempt to find the culture in pop culture. We are recording this actually on my 38th birthday, and my guest is giving me one hell of a birthday present. His resume could take up almost the whole show, but very quickly he is has written critically acclaimed audio plays for Big Finish Productions for their licensed programming of Doctor Who, Sapphire and Steel, The Tomorrow People, and Dark Shadows. He has also written for BBC, British Television, for Torchwood, and The Sarah Jane Adventures, both of which are spin-offs of the worldwide phenomenon of Doctor Who. He's also written for Wizards and Aliens. He has also written the content for a British mystery show you may be familiar with called Sherlock. Doctor Who fans can also find him on some DVD special features with the very funny Josie Long and the very erudite Simon Guerrier, and he recently won the Audience Favorite Writer Award for his play Nice Sally in the Offcut Theater Festival. And when he's not doing that, he's helping our mutual friend Simon Guerrier with his kick-ass short film, Cleaning Up. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the Handsome Timidity Express, Mr. Joe Lidster.
Hello.
Hello, thanks so much.
I don't know what to say to all of that.
I know. Oh, that's right, you are my first British guest.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, sorry for the compliments. My deepest apologies.
No, that's fine.
And it's funny, thanks to the wonderful world of Doctor Who, I have found myself blessed to know quite a few British writers and television professionals, and I was going back and forth and very torn about who to ask to be on the podcast, and I thought, I'm going to ask the one guy I know but who I had never met in person, Joe Lister. We only know each other online, so this is our first proper conversation together.
It is. Yeah.
And we met because I emailed you as a fan, actually, because Joe Lister wrote a play, an audio play, for Big Finish Productions. It's called Master. It was part of the Villains Trilogy in 2003 for Doctor Who's 40th anniversary. And I was so mad when I heard it. It's one of those plays I wish I'd never heard it so I could hear it again for the first time. It is an absolutely chilling, gothic, a wonderful murder mystery, but at the same time a very serious and dramatic exploration of good versus evil. For Doctor Who fans, and it also fits right in with the new series in some ways when looking at the opposite sides of the coin with David Tennant and John Sim. In this one, in Master, you created a scenario in which the Master has amnesia and doesn't realize he's an evil man. And when the Doctor turns up, that sends him for all kinds of difficult moral questions. Tell me about Master and how all of that came about.
Well, it was my second play for Big Finish.
Sure.
And I was quite lucky because my first one didn't go down very well at all. It's still bottom of the polls. But luckily, I was commissioned by Big Finish. Yeah, Gary Russell emailed me and said, would I like to write another one before The Rapture came out and got the response it did. And it was quite straightforward. They had the Villains Trilogy idea that they were doing. And then another writer, another two writers, I think it was Cav Scott and Mark Wright, I think both of them were going to be writing the play about the Master. And they'd come up with this idea of the Master being amnesiac. So you wouldn't know who he was, and it would be with the Seventh Doctor. And then they were taken off because they were doing something else around that time. I don't know if it's Project Lazarus or something came out that year. So Gary emailed me and said, would I be interested in writing a Sylvester and Jeffrey Beaver's story where the Master has lost his memory? And I said, yes, obviously. And yeah, it was really cool. It was a really fun thing to do. It was quite, I wanted to do something very different to The Rapture, which had been sort of very modern, very young. It was all young people. It was in Ibiza. It was aliens taking over the world with dance music and drugs. And I wanted to sort of... I always, even now, like to do different things. And so I'm always desperate once I've done one thing. I want to do something completely different for the next thing I write. And so, yeah, I wanted to do something very different. So I just sort of thought, I want to do something a bit posh, was how it started. And my favourite play is Amadeus. And it's very... Amadeus is very sort of, you know, got long speeches in. It's very dramatic, very operatic, obviously. And I sort of wanted to do something a bit like that. So it was a case of going well. I think in the, what I've been told as well is it had to be on an alien planet. And I'm not very good at alien planets, so I sort of said, well, it'd be on an old-fashioned Earth. I think it was an Earth colony, but it would be like, so it meant I could be a sort of old-fashioned Earth and stuff, and stuck in a couple of New Adventures references, because they were my Doctor Who. And so then I just sat there and thought, well, what can I do with it? And I think it was just a case of going, well, he's an evil man and he doesn't know who he is. So is he still evil? You know, what he remember? How much of it is part of him and how much of it is, it's difficult to say, how much of it is things he's done and how much of it is intrinsically part of him? You know, are people born evil? And it's all that nature versus nurture stuff. And it was trying to find a sort of dramatic way to do that. And then I started to sort of think about things like Jekyll and Hyde and that, which there are references to, and just thought of, you know, how the tricky thing always when you get a sort of brief like that is I could write an essay, I could write a monologue of the nature of good versus bad and things like that, but you have to make it a piece of drama as well. And so it was a case of, well, how can I do that? And so I sort of had the idea of this sort of Jekyll and Hyde thing, and there were murders happening in this town. So I kind of had that style of it. And then I thought, and then it was the characters in the house talking, but then they all ended up in the Master's mind, and it was all very dramatic and very silly. And I think it was Gary said, no, don't do that, just keep them in the house. And and it was a real challenge, but a really sort of fun challenge, because it was basically five characters in a house. And one of them, well, three or four of them aren't who they appear to be. So it was good, yeah.
Well, it's funny because for those who are not super familiar with Doctor Who, like us, you and I are hardcore fans, and I hope this isn't alienating anybody who's not. We'll try to keep it pretty straightforward. But like, what's interesting about the Master as a villain, he's always trying to manipulate the events in most of his episodes. Sometimes he succeeds, sometimes he fails. You know, thinking of things like Colony in Space, especially, or The King's Demons, he's been planning this for a long time, and everybody's sort of dancing to his strings. In Master, the same thing kind of happens, but almost accidentally. And it's his search for his good and evil side that almost manipulates everybody else's. Because it starts with the Doctor going, oh my God, what have I done? He's not the man who I think he is, because that affects how the Doctor makes his decisions. And because, you know, the Master holds the dinner party for the Victor and his wife, Jacqueline. And Jacqueline's actually in love with the Master, and that all starts coming out. And accidentally, it all manipulates them, but on a real emotional level, which I thought was just fascinating and brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, it came about because the tricky thing is, the Master's not a hugely well-defined character. He's evil in the TV series. So sometimes he wants to take over the Earth. Sometimes he wants to destroy things. Sometimes, you know, he sort of kind of wants to dominate. He wants to be the Master, hence his name. But he's kind of got different... He's not... There isn't a sort of... There isn't much to work with. You know, you sort of go, well, he's urbane, or he's, you know, or even when you say he's manipulative or whatever. But when you actually break it down to what he wants, it's quite difficult to sort of go, well, what does he want? And so it was trying to explore that. And then the one thing I did think, you know, one thing I looked at was, well, the one thing he always achieves is death. He, wherever he goes, he brings death, because he kills people and people die because of him, and so on. And so it was kind of exploring that. And going, well, why does death, you know, why is he who he is? You know, and trying to sort of do a character-based story, but without putting loads of sort of, is it retconning, they call it, without suddenly going, well, you see, all along, he's really wanted this, because you sort of go, well, that's just too much. So it was that, really, and it just sort of came out from that, and that gave it the atmosphere, and that sort of gave me the characters, because it sort of went, well, obviously it's going to be a murder mystery, but obviously he can't be the killer, because he's the most obvious one, so who's the killer and what's going on? And it just gave me a really nice thing, and it gave me a chance to write an episode that's effectively a two-hander between the Doctor and the Master, which is a, you know, such an amazing opportunity. I think any writer on any kind of, you know, it's Sherlock and Moriarty, it's Captain Kirk and a Klingon or Khan or whatever, you know, I think the chance to actually write 25 minutes of your hero and your main villain just talking was you know, it was just an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, and they're talking like this isn't a knock on like John Sim and David Tennant fighting on the cliffs, but they're talking in a living room on a couch,
yeah,
with books fall over books with a brandy on the table, you know, like it's very intimate and a lot of things.
You do that in the new TV series because all the kids watching be bored.
I know, it's a well when they grow up.
Oh God, it's just people talking. The great thing about doing the Doctor Who audios is people are paying 14, 15 quid for these CDs. You know they're going to listen to them properly, and you know that they're older, and you know they have disposable income, and that they're fans of the show. Yeah. So you can be more experimental in that way, in the way that the TV series would struggle to do.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's just different mediums and different demos, like you're saying. And just, I just want to throw out a quick thing. The Big Finish link will be at the bottom of the page. When Doctor Who was off the air, not the global phenomenon that it is, when the new adventure line of novels, that was my Doctor Who as well. Big Finish Productions was started by Jason Higgellery and Gary Russell and Nick Briggs. They got the license to produce original Doctor Who audio plays. So these guys, writers like Joe Lidster and Simon Guerrier and people we're going to reference, they were the guys making Doctor Who before Christopher Eccleston said run. And they're still producing great Doctor Who today. So go down to that link and check out some of that work. I have to go to bat for the Rapture. Let's get a comeback going because I love the Rapture. I like techno. I've never been to Ibiza, if I'm saying that right. And one of the things that I really like and want to talk about, your writing happens in the Rapture. I think you tackle really difficult stuff head on, and you don't hesitate it. You know, your episode of Torchwood starts with a woman about to commit suicide. And one of the things I like...
It's cheerful, isn't it?
It's cheerful, but it's...
What they all write a sitcom.
It's powerful. Well, it is. Yeah. It's also funny when Owen Harper, when Owen says to her, God, you're a pain in the ass.
Yes.
You know, funny, that's sensitive. But you tackle this stuff head on, and you do it... I think sometimes we writers, all of us, can sometimes have a tendency to overthink things. And one of the things that jumped out at me when the Rapture, and also it's probably one of the first stories in Doctor Who to really take on mental illness in a straightforward way with the character of Kat. And I just remember her saying, I don't remember the exact dialogue, forgive me, but she just says, you know, she's like, I feel bad and I don't know why. And then I think of other people who have it worse than me, and then I feel even worse and I don't know how to feel better again. And I was sitting there going, yeah, that's it, isn't it? I mean, that really is hopefully not an oversimplification, but a way for us to understand.
Yeah. I mean, it's no sort of getting around it. It's something I've suffered from in the past. It's something I still suffer from. You know, I've sort of got it under control, but no, not long before writing the Rapture. Fact, it would have been the summer I was writing. It was when I really got, you know, very serious depression and stuff. And, you know, and I sort of knew what it was and read about it and stuff. And, I think the reason I did it with The Rapture was I wanted to write something. I wanted to write a Doctor Who story. I hadn't actually heard that many Big Finish CDs. But, you know, so my Doctor Who had been, I sort of remember the end of Colin, then Sylvester, which was experimental and a bit more real worldy, you know, or trying to be real world and doing things like Survival and Curse of Fenric and stuff.
Good.
It was, I love it, yeah.
Curse of Fenric's one of the best Doctor Who's ever. Anyway,
just amazing.
Brilliant.
And then the New Adventures, which were obviously a lot more experimental, were successfully and unsuccessfully, you know, doing strong characters and arcs and angst and things like that. So I didn't know, you know, this isn't the DVDs were out, but I don't think I had any Doctor Who videos or anything, so I hadn't gone back and watched anything or anything. So I just sort of thought, well, if I was writing a Doctor Who story now, and this was in 2001, end of 2001 when I started writing it, if I was writing a Doctor Who story now, bear in mind I haven't heard a Big Finish, what would it be? And I thought, well, it's the Yeti on the loo in Tooting Beck, which John Pertwee always used to say, that's the perfect Doctor Who, is when you are in a real-world situation and there's an alien there. And at that time, my life was I was going clubbing all the time. I loved it, and it's been a few years since I've been properly. I'm too old now.
Oh, well, but, welcome to it, my brother.
I know, yeah. But I still listen to music and stuff. I just listen to it at home with a glass of wine rather than out drinking whatever. But I was just thinking, well, if somebody did Doctor Who now, it would be modern. And I kind of, I mean, I think it was divisive because there's a whole group of Doctor Who fans who don't know that world at all. And whereas my thought was, well, this is what I live like. So presumably this is what other Doctor Who fans live like. And this is a perfect thing. You set a Doctor Who story in a nightclub. And also I was thinking, well, audio, it would be perfect. And then what I thought was, well, you'd have strong characters because that's what the end of Sylvester certainly had, stronger characters. The new adventures had been quite often character led. And I was thinking about things like modern television that I watched and thought, well, you'd have strong characters. I mean, I it was my first audio. I think it's probably very clunky in places because they are all very strongly defined characters to the point where, you know, I've not heard it in years, but I imagine you are wanting people to shut up because they are saying what their character is rather than acting what their character is. But that's what I wanted. So I wanted a Christian. I thought, you know, a Christian who drinks and goes clubbing, and that's an interesting thing. And I thought, well, I've got this depression thing, and it's an interesting thing, and it sort of ties in with the themes of the story. And so it was a case of trying to just to make. I just thought it'd be an interesting character to put in Doctor Who. You know, there wasn't any kind of big. I would say there's any kind of big thought process. It was just a case of, well, who's this character going to be? And I thought, well, what I'd been through and what I knew other people had gone through, I just thought that was an interesting character, and it made her vulnerable, possibly to you know, especially as these were aliens who were sort of mind controlling people and all that lot. Did it make her vulnerable to that? You know, what was her personality like? And I just thought it'd be more interesting to have characters like that rather than generic. These are two teenagers who go out drinking, go to Ibiza and go clubbing. It was like, well, you know, how can I just find ways to make them a bit different, a bit more interesting? And also to tie in with, I'd been asked to put all this Ace angst in from her previous story. And so it tied in with that. It was like, well, Ace is depressed because she's seen somebody die in a TARDIS or something. And I thought, well, you know, it sort of ties in with that. They've all got their own issues for different reasons. And, you know, hers is, Katrina's is mental illness. You know, she's depressed.
Well, firstly, I think on behalf of all Doctor Who fans in the late 90s, thank you for thinking we were spending all our time in nightclubs. which was not the case. But, well, it's so funny. That's such an interesting thing. I'm shocked to hear this to a degree because I remember listening. I listened to Master first, and then I heard Rapture. And when Kat was being so open about what she was going through, I was like, holy shit, nobody ever does this in Doctor Who. This is so open and honest. And I just think,
well, I think it's something I you know.
It's interesting. I mean, you're like, oh, that's how it's done.
It's this week with what's happened, you know, with Robin Williams, it's like, it is, you know, people should be open about it. People don't pretend they don't have cancer.
Yeah.
And so people shouldn't pretend that they don't suffer from depression, you know, that it should be seen as a real thing. It is, I mean, obviously medically in that it's seen as a real thing, but I think in you know, generally people need to see it as a real thing. And I think what's happened to Robin Williams is absolute proof of that.
Yeah.
You know, and we've seen comments on articles over here. We've had comments in a not particularly good newspaper. But there were comments on it going, what did he have to be depressed about? He was earning millions and he had a beautiful wife and everything. And it's like, you really don't understand.
Not even close.
That goes right back to what Katrina says, where she goes, I feel guilty because there are people here with real issues and I haven't got a real issue. I'm my life's fine. And yet I'm depressed all the time.
Which is, in fact, a real issue because we don't. We're not, you know, defining this stuff yet. I wrote about it last week in the blog, and it's basically what I wrote was, I don't know anything. I don't know anything, and I don't understand this stuff. And we all kind of have to admit that. We've got to stop. And I don't mean to get on a soapbox here, Joe, but like, I'm tired of hearing people call suicide the coward's way out. And we've got to redefine some of this stuff. And I did some research. Like, we call it mental illness. There's 300 plus different variations.
Oh, yeah.
I use this example in my blog. That's like going to a restaurant, and the waiter says, what would you like to drink? I'll have a liquid. It's we're not even close to scratching the surface. And I know in my life, my dad was an alcohol drug counselor. I know therapists. I know psychiatrists. I know people. And, you know, we are in the infancy of figuring this stuff out. If it's not too personal a question, when you wrote about this stuff, from almost the objective view as the writer, was that cathartic? Was there a healing to it, or were you actually more objective about it?
I wouldn't say it was necessarily cathartic. I was very pleased that I did it, I think was the thing. And I was very sort of... I was very happy with her performance. I thought Anne gave a really good performance because she actually played her quite unlikable in some respects. She played her quite sort of very loud and gobby. And again, that was something I wanted to do. I think I had this real issue with people thinking depressed people sit around in their dressing gowns in dark rooms being depressed. And it's like, no, it's you look at someone who's loud and is the life and soul of a party, and they might be the person who is depressed. You know, there are different forms of it and all that lot. But I was very pleased to sort of do that, to have a character who was loud and in your face and cheeky and drinking and popping pills and dancing and stuff. And actually, she is incredibly depressed. And, and again, it's the Robin Williams thing. You go, but he was so funny.
Yeah.
He can't have been depressed. He was so funny. He made people laugh. And it's like, well, no, that's the thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't cathartic, but it was, I was very happy to do it. I'm very proud sort of to have done it in my first play as well. I was very proud to have done that. To sort of have hopefully done something a little bit different and that.
And it's still, and I would dare say, because of we're in the shadow of Robin Williams and hopefully, in some ways, an improved conversation on this. I think it's going to take a long time to really fix, so to speak, but hopefully the conversation will improve and understand. I am somebody, I'll confess, God almighty, I'm sure a couple stints with a therapist would do me a world of good. I'm somebody who, unfortunately, has had some really harmful experiences with mentally ill people, and that has led me to be somebody who kind of stigmatized. But then again, at the same time, I've had close friends who've had really, and it's figuring out, and it's, and again, like, I don't know anything. I don't know a goddamn thing about it.
It's that thing that you sort of go, it's like cancer. Yeah. Anybody can get it. You could be the nicest person in the world, or you could be a right bastard. You could still have depression. You could still get cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually just wrote a short play. There's a theme. I wrote a short play that was on a couple of months ago, where it was basically based on sort of an own experience I'd had, where someone phoned me up, and an old school friend phoned me up and was chatting to me, and then basically said he was going to kill himself that night.
Oh,
and I was like, well, I can't do anything about this. I don't know where you live. You're not, I haven't seen you in 20 years. I don't know where you live. Look, just go to bed. There's nothing, just go to bed. And he sounded fine. He wasn't crying or anything like that. But I was worried. And so Facebooked his brother, found his brother on Facebook and sent a message going, you don't know me, but, and got a message back a couple of days later. And my friend had actually, killed himself.
Oh my gosh.
And it was awful. But what his brother said was, you actually gave him some comfort on his last night, because you spoke to him and stuff. But so I wrote a play, and, it's a guy rings up a stranger and says, and he's taken insulin overdose. He's diabetic. He's taken an insulin overdose, so he's got 10 minutes left to live. And what he does is, he's quite awful with her. He basically rings up the stranger and says to her, you can save my life if you can guess where I live. And people were, I think some people were a bit, what a horrible thing to do.
Yeah.
But it was working out that actually what he really needed was, he needed someone who would just talk to him for 10 minutes while he died. Because he had decided he was going to die. There was no way a stranger could find him. So he decided he was going to die. And actually she works out that what he needs is just someone to comfort him for those 10 minutes as they're talking. But I mean, they go through hell because she's obviously shouting at him and going, and she's trying to find out where it is. But then she's also saying to him, why are you putting this on me? And again, it's that thing of just going, just because he's got depression, just because he's himself, doesn't mean he's a nice person. He could do something really quite horrible like that. And I think that's, yeah, that's the big thing for me. It's sort of, it's just trying to take away from that thing of people thinking it's someone sitting in a dark room being miserable. When it can take, it can be all any type of person in any situation.
Yeah, and I think we're far too often as, I think there's far too much looking down the nose at it. And I say that as somebody who's guilty of it myself. And I'm saying this publicly and I'm writing it publicly. So hopefully in my old age, as I enter my 40s, I do better. Yeah, I don't like it when people say, oh, you're so sensitive, or oh, you have issues. Hold on a second. What if that person really does have issues? What if that person really is struggling and you're just sitting there making fun of them? Maybe just, I don't know, like, I don't want to oversimplify. And I'm not sitting here as any kind of trained professional, Joe. I'm just some guy talking. But I just wonder, like, is there not some bit of kindness, consideration, understanding? Sure, she's mad about being on the phone for 10 minutes, but this character you're talking about may look back on that as, like, a real life-changing event. Later on in their lives, of like, oh my God, what did I actually do some good? You know, this is very, very complicated stuff, and I think all of us, you know, and it needs to rethink and it needs to be open to new understandings. And as I was writing my blog about this and everything, I don't have as personal an experience as you do, but I can't think of anybody in my life who has not struggled with something.
Yeah,
that is like a mental illness. There's nobody, and I was thinking about that. I'm like, nobody's avoided this at all. We all need to sort of stop and take a look. But you are, again, you don't run away from this stuff. You tackle it and you embrace it and you write it. Is that a difficult thing to do? Do you ever sit there and go, oh my God, this is too hard. This is too emotional. Or is it really, nope, this is something I have to write?
No, I'm quite, it's possibly not the right thing to say. I'm quite cold about it when I'm writing about it. I'm quite, I've cried listening to things or watching things because of how brilliant the actors have been and so on. But actually when I'm writing it, while I will put myself into the characters' heads and things like that, I'm actually quite cold about it. I'm quite sort of, you know, I don't sit there crying while I'm writing or anything like that. I used to just sit there drinking wine and going, oh, that could be fun. I'm quite cold about it then. I've seen some actors do some amazing performances and just been amazing. And that's made me cry, you know, and also I gave them their words, so I should be a little bit proud, but it's their performance that's done it. It's quite, my thing is, I suppose my big thing was, even back then doing the audios, there's nothing worse than something that's boring.
Yeah.
And I think even the people who hated my first story, The Rapture, I don't think anybody would ever say it was boring. It's just not what they like. And also, to be fair, it's my first script. It's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. The last episode's terrible. But it's that thing of me going, I just never, ever want to write something boring or mediocre or anything like that. I mean, I don't think any writer sets out to do that, but I've got a real big thing about it. So I will have things that are OTT or things that people might see as melodramatic or whatever, because to me it's, you know, you can tone it down. But you know, I have heard some Doctor Who stories and that where I have gone, really? That's your, you've got two hours to tell your greatest Doctor Who story ever, that's really going to affect people, whatever. And you sort of go, is that it? That's what you came up with? There've been ones I've hated, but I can see what they're doing. And I think, well, good on you. You've really done something. It doesn't appeal to me, but there have been some, I mean, not many, but there have been some where I have listened to them and gone, that's just pointless. There's nothing there to engage with particularly. It's like wallpaper. It's just there. And I think it's, you know, and I think it's possibly why my audios are quite divisive, is because sometimes people have just gone, oh God, here he goes again, because I will try and write something that's a bit dramatic.
Well, you know.
it's saying something about the world or about a character or something.
The Reaping is a tough listen. I don't mind telling you. The Reaping is just a full-on tragedy. And it's not a retcon, but we see this side of Perry, that Perry basically has nobody left to travel with. That's why she's with the Doctor.
But you see, again, I was quite cold about that, you know, and it's only when I listened to it and just went, oh, God, that's awful. But, you know, I was quite cold in writing it because that had been my plan all along. You know, that was where the whole story came from. It was that thing in the old series that, you know, sometimes did words and go, shouldn't anybody be worrying about her going home?
Yeah.
She's got a whole family at home and, all right, I know she gets taken out of time or whatever it is, but it's like, shouldn't the Doctor be trying to take her home to see her family and shouldn't she want to be going home at some point? You know, so it was that thing of going, well, that was kind of my, I suppose, first thought was, well, why wouldn't she go home? And also, yes, a slightly fan wanky thing of why are her and the Doctor, why are they so much nicer to each other in The Trial of a Time Lord than they are previously? It's because her mum's dead. So he's being nice to her.
You know,
it was that thing of going, I'm writing a tragedy, you know, I'm, you know, sometimes you know what it is, you're writing a tragedy, so it's all about leading up to that, and hopefully making it fun on the way. I mean, that's always my big thing when doing anything like this, is you've got to like the characters, so they've got to be fun. The characters have to be people you want to spend time with, so that you're sad when they die, or whatever. It's no good if they are miserable from the first minute of the story. And that was certainly something I worked hard on in The Reaping, was getting that balance right. So it wasn't just angst. It was people being funny, people being witty, people being clever. You know, these are adults, you know, and they are fun to be with. They're just then put in a horrible situation.
Yeah. You seem to have the knack for the, or just interest in domesticity. Juxtaposed with the science fiction and like The Reaping and like Daisy Chain, Your Sapphire and Steel, you know.
Oh yeah, it's another cheery one.
Yeah, boy. And but just a real quick aside, one day I'm gonna put on the blog. If you actually watch the Colin Baker season 22 out of order, like if you start with Revelation of the Daleks and Time Lash and then end with Attack of the Cybermen on Vengeance on Varus, the Doctor Perry relationship tracks much better.
Oh, really?
I think so, because in Attack of the Cybermen, Doctor and Perry get along great. They don't have a crossword at all. But in Revelation of the Daleks, she still has her mad at him from Twin Dilemma and all that shit.
Yeah.
And if you start with... And the other thing, too, is because he's not in Revelation of the Daleks that much. It's almost a better season opener, because you're, like, still waiting to find out what this Doctor is like.
Yeah.
And I think if you watch it out of order, it might track a bit. But you should also still, dear reader and listener, check out The Reaping. which we'll give it to that. I do want to... That coldness is an interesting thing you talk about. I don't know a word for it yet. And, you know, I wrote I live with a Jewish girlfriend, and I remember walking in one day, walking in the bedroom at night, and she said, how was the writing today? And I said, well, it was filled with domestic violence and anti-Semitism. And it just was. And you, as a writer, I think there's some sort of switch or something. It's hard to explain to people who don't write. Like, if I am going to write about this stuff, I have to be honest. I have to be objective. Like you said, maybe you will. I don't mind telling you, I've cried at the keyboard. But you have to go through it. And I think you have to make that commitment. And I it's a hard thing.
And it's not about not taking it seriously.
Just the opposite, yeah.
I mean, Daisy Chain is very hard, because Daisy Chain... although it in no way resembles my family, was based a lot of the conversations and that happened in it, the domesticity in it, is based on my own family at that time. And so to do what I do at the end of the play is very hard. Mm-hmm. And you are taking it very, very seriously. But also there's just part of me that's going, that's the end of the play. That's where this is leading up to. You can't get so into it that you're then going, well, I'll change the ending so it's a happy ending. You know, it's you've just got to have that sort of, and you hear actors say it, you know, when they're doing a tough storyline in a soap or whatever, you've got to be able to switch off from it.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to be able to go, I mean, God, the play that was on recently, this, you know, sort of suicide play. I mean, me and the two actors and the director just got drunk, and we had a laugh. We were winding each other up. We were taking the mick out of the play. You know, we were going, she should just hang up on him at the beginning. You know, or he shouldn't, because he has to sing at the beginning of the play, and the actress didn't like singing. He was like, oh, when we do the first performance, I'm just not going to ring. So she has to keep singing the song. You know, you've got to have that laugh to it, that then you then, when you are writing it or when they're performing it, they then go 100% into it. And God, they were amazing, those two actors. They gave absolutely heartbreaking performances. But then they were able, 5 minutes later, to switch off from it. We'd go and have a pint, and we'd have a laugh. And I think that's what you've got to do with the writing, because otherwise it's not healthy, you know.
And I can't help but wonder, some of those plays, and we don't have to name drop, any play that you think of that didn't speak to you or didn't resonate, you know, for any viewer, I almost wonder if the person who wrote that was kind of afraid a little bit to go there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if they, because I know I've had to overcome some fears, like, am I really going to write about this?
Yeah.
And, I can't help but wonder, is... another question. Here in Hollywood, a lot of us aspiring screenwriters are bombarded with take this structure webinar and take this course on how to do your pilot. And we are bombarded by a lot of format and story structure stuff, some of which is fantastic, great, super helpful. But I don't see enough of here's how you write a story from your guts. Here's how you write a story from your heart. Here's how you write a story with truth and honesty and have that cold switch to be able to say, I am going to write this story about suicide or racism or depression or schizophrenia, what have you. I interviewed these two producers two episodes ago, and they're writing about alcoholism and drug addiction now, and the stuff they're doing next, holy cow. Is that something that, were you trained on doing that? Or is...
I did... English literature in sort of A levels, I don't know what you'd call that over there, before you go to college, university. Mm-hmm. And then I did media at university, and we learned some scriptwriting stuff, but I don't remember us learning much about structure, because the whole course was, here's how to hold a camera, here's how to write a script, here's how to be in a thing, you know, it was all quite sort of low level of everything. So I didn't really know that much about it. And then last year, so I was kind of, I was aware things needed from beginning, middle and end, you know, and that kind of thing. But last year I did a training thing for the BBC Soap EastEnders.
Hmm.
And that was brilliant. It was so helpful for teaching you things like the act structure and stuff. Now, I don't think about the act structure when I'm writing. There's a show I'm working on at the moment where they do 1-5 act structure. Before you go to script, and I kind of just go, well, you've got the treatment, I'll cut it into 5 bits and add a little cliffhanger at the end of each one, and I hope that's right. But what those things can teach you is actually, and again, going back to the suicide play I just did, the suicide play, that sounds all very demeaning, but the problem I had with that, when I sat down to start writing it, was, again, the problem I always have is, how can I make this a story and not just a piece of angst? And a big thing I'd learned on the EastEnders course was look at what your character wants and what they need. And so I sat down and did that for both those two characters. So I had the vague structure of it worked out because, you know, he's got 10 minutes and so on. And I kind of knew a lot of the stuff that he was going to say and that she was going to say. But it was sitting there and going, well, what I've got to do is go, what does he want? What does he need? And so what he wants is, he says, it's like an episode of 24. This is exciting. I want 10 minutes of exciting. You'll either find me, in which case you'll save me and I'll be excited at 24, or you won't and I'll die, and that'll be something new and exciting. What he actually needs is someone to talk to him for 10 minutes while he dies. And it's the same with her. It was then going for her. She has to work, so she becomes the stronger character because she works out what he needs. And so that's where those things are really helpful. It's when they encourage you to start thinking like that while writing something. I don't agree with you have to sit down and work everything out technically beforehand because I think you've got to write from your gut. I mean, sometimes you are writing for a series that's very structured, and so you've got to know it at the beginning. But there's always got to be that gut thing at the beginning of it of what am I telling a story of, rather than who's my protagonist? Who's my antagonist? You know, where's the turning points go and things like that? Because actually what I think you'll find is that's quite natural. If you're writing stories, as long as you know it's got to be a beginning, middle and end, a lot of the other stuff kind of comes naturally.
You took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah, you know, because you're doing something at the beginning, middle and end, so you've already got your three major points there. But it is useful I did find that EastEnders course incredibly useful for making me think about things like that. And I think I wrote a better play because of it.
It's so funny. I mean, I'm sorry, Joe.
Sorry, I was just saying, but it was that thing of it coming afterwards. It was that thing of going, right, well, this is my play. This is the idea I have. These are my two characters. I know how it's going to end. I know how it's going to begin. And da, 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 da. So I could have written it there and then. But I think I started writing it. And I went, right, now I need to work out what they want and what they need, what both characters want and what both characters need. And once I did that, that really helped structure it as a story. But yes, you need that good instinct at the beginning of what you're telling.
No, absolutely. I can't agree more. Yeah, because I think structure and format is so important. And it's, you know, I have a lot of experience in post-production work with editors, and the best editors tell me they know when a scene feels right. And yeah. I think you have, like you just described that when you're writing, like, you know that, oh, I'm on page 80. Uh-oh, it's starting to feel like, you can feel it sometimes. You can almost feel what page number you're on without looking, if you're hopefully doing it right. I think structure is absolutely important. I'm not trying to bag on that stuff so much, but I worry at times that this new generation of Hollywood screenwriters and a lot of the people who are coming through the system now are trying to break in. I just have a worry, maybe I'm wrong, that we're teaching structure first and not, like, you know, I have a story about my grandmother who came over to Ellis Island or whatever, and it was this really powerful thing. Well, don't lose that within the structure. That's going to be the thing. Okay, we don't have a ton of time left, but I want to touch upon something that I know you're a big fan of, and I'm not that familiar with it at all. My mom watched Dark Shadows all the time, but you've got some new plays out. Big Finish, they don't just do Doctor Who. They're doing all kinds of licenses, and they're just doing Dark Shadows. Tell us about some of your Dark Shadow stuff.
It's brilliant. I knew the old producer, a guy called Stuart Manning, and he set it up with Big Finish. He sort of arranged for it all to happen. And I was good mates and lived with him at the time. You know, we were sort of flatmates. And you support your flatmates, but I was just like, I have no idea what this thing you're on about is. I've never heard of Dark Shadows. And I listened to his audios, and they were great. But I was like, I should try and watch this TV series. And it's this 60s soap opera. And it's always got a very gothic atmosphere and stuff and hints of ghosts and that. And they have a supernatural storyline, and they sort of see the viewers spike a little bit. And then about 200 episodes in, they bring in a vampire. He's a full-on proper vampire. Mm-hmm. And you have 10 or 20 episodes of people in the local bar sort of sitting there talking, going, well, I don't know. Joe still loves Maggie. Does Joe still have feelings for Maggie? And, you know, or for Carolyn? I don't know. I think everything's fine. And then someone will come in and go, I don't want to interrupt, but all the sheep in town have had their blood drained from them. Oh, no. And then they'll go back to their other storylines and stuff. And it's this brilliant sort of strange world at the time. And it's just this amazing thing. So I started watching it, and I just got addicted to it. It's brilliant. It's basically a soap opera with ghosts and vampires and werewolves in. And I wrote one, and then Stuart decided he didn't want to do any more of the sort of two strands. There's the sort of full cast dramas and the sort of two-handed plays called dramatic readings. And he decided he didn't have time to do the dramatic readings anymore. And I'd never produced anything in my life. But, so me and a mate of mine, James Goss, said, well, we could do it, you know, and, we did. And James has since gone on to do other things, and I've got another co-producer, David Darlington. But yeah, it's I love it. I'm getting to be the boss, which is nice, because I basically script edit it. And because it's a soap opera, what we've tried to do is put soapy stuff in the audios. So each audio should be a standalone great horror story. But there are serial elements in it, and it's great because I'm getting to do my dream job, which is plot out a soap opera. And I'm getting to be the boss, which is nice because, you know, it's brilliant being a writer, but there are times you're just like, oh, can't I just be in charge just once? And so I am, I'm getting to be in charge. So yeah, we've done some brilliant stuff, and then I've been writing for it again, actually. We're doing a 13 half hour episodes mini series, called Bloodlust, which is coming out in January. There'll be a link somewhere on this page.
Yeah. We'll do a Bloodlust interview in January.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, basically, what we did was we've sort of gone... The last full cast series ended on a cliffhanger, but that was about 3 or 4 years ago. And we thought, we can't follow on directly from that cliffhanger. It certainly won't encourage new listeners to give it a go, because they'll be sitting there going, what the heck is the Hand of Potofi? Who are these two people? Why do they have a hand of somebody? So we've sort of gone, well, what we did was we had to come up with a different storyline that storyline can then continue in the background of, or go back to it or whatever. And we've ended up doing Twin Peaks. We've ended up doing The Killing. Just purely by chance, we've ended up doing that, and we've put so, and that's where a lot of the plotting stuff has gone in, of what do people want, what do they need, where's our turning points, does this scene have a point, because it's got to be so tightly condensed, because there are so many characters and so much going on, and yes, it's a big old spooky murder mystery where with vampires and witches and werewolves and that. It's so, yeah, we've nearly finished writing it. We start recording it next month.
What's old is new again. I mean, yeah. This stuff is hot as a pistol. I mean, Dark Shadow's well ahead of its time.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. No. I mean, people talk about Stephen Moffat's Doctor Who being timey-wimey. Dark Shadows, at one point, they go back in time sometimes, and they were having a whole load of storylines in 1897. And they realised the sort of two heroes who've gone back in time, Barnabas and Julia, I think they've realised Beth the Maid is going to die, or Beth the Maid has died and they want to find out why. So Julia says, well, I'll pop back to 1969 and speak to a ghost. So she goes back to 1969, speaks to Beth ghost, find out why, how she dies, and then goes back into the past. And you just go, that's just brilliant. That's so clever. And, you know, this is being shot as live. It's just amazing. And we've tried to do that with this, with Bloodlust especially. We've really tried to go, let's sometimes, oh, it's a horrible phrase, but think outside the box. Let's try and do stuff that's a little bit, so it's not just a spooky ghost and a spooky house. Let's, we have quite a funny thing happen to a character halfway through the series, which I think one of us suggested as a joke. And then we sort of went, nope, we that's actually really fun. And quite, yeah, so we're doing that. So yeah, it's really good. I'm really excited about it. Me and the other two writers have worked really hard, much harder than we should have done, because we just got absolutely addicted to it. We've actually, you know, we've sat there and gone, every scene, what's this person doing? Right, let's get those two together. Let's get them closer to a relationship. Right, well, you know, if we want them to think that that person is the killer, have we established where they were when the first murder happens and where they were in the second? You know, I'm just really working on how can we make somebody have a secret? You know, obviously, like all those shows do, it's often, well, Joe wasn't there on the night that I nearly said the murder victim's name then. Joe wasn't there on the night that such and such a character died. And then it's finding out that actually, no, Joe has another secret that's related to something else. And it's doing that kind of thing. So yeah, it should be hopefully really exciting.
And people devour it. I mean, I think everybody can hear your smile coming over the, Skype here. And, all right, cool. Well, listen, and then, all right, when this goes out this Saturday,
yeah,
Mr. Capaldi will be taking the reins as Doctor Who. How do you feel about it? Are you excited? Any predictions?
Yeah, no, I think he'll be brilliant. I think you know, it's a nice change to sort of, after, you know, a couple of younger doctors, it's nice to have an older doctor. And I just think he's an amazing actor, which to me is always the really important thing. It's why I was so excited when Christopher Eccleston was announced, because I just went, I don't care if he looks doctorish or not in real life or whatever. He's just an absolutely astonishing actor, which is just brilliant. And I think the same with Peter. I just think he's an amazing actor. He is going to bring something to the role. He is going to be something different, and that, you know, and you know, I think every doctor we've had, especially in the new series, has been brilliant in their own way. And I think Peter will be like the others. He'll bring something new and different to it, and I think he'll have a different feel to it. Which would be a nice change. You know, it's what Doctor Who should always do. Every couple of years, Doctor Who should, you know, regenerate, not just the actor, but the show, the feel of it. You know, it should constantly evolve. I'm very excited.
Yeah, he has such he has such a strange presence. He has a real bona fide, even in Fires of Pompeii, he has a charisma that is just sort of your eye goes, and I mean, Malcolm Tucker, my God, it's just, you know.
Yeah.
And what's also curious to me, though, what I'm excited about is this is the first time in which we have somebody who's been watching. He's been watching Doctor Who longer than both of us combined, Joe.
Yeah.
Like, he's seen everything from day one. So when you don't have to explain to him what the Monoptera are, or yes. or the Monoids or anything, those will actually be real Doctor memories. I'm very curious to see how that kind of influences his immortalness of the role.
All right. Yeah, I agree.
One last question is, you have a bit of a hobby on the old social media of the food porn. You are one of those people who posts numerous pictures of all your meals. Now, the desserts and stuff, I totally understand.
I'm not just all suicide, you know. I like food as well.
Yeah, you like food, you like wine, you like a laugh. Let's be honest, you know. But the English breakfasts, I've never actually visited the United Kingdom, sadly, and hopefully I hope to one day. We'll take
you
a
should.
Month. I'll have
you
to take a
their
month
amazing
to see
food.
All you guys. Yeah, and well, that's the thing. And sometimes England doesn't get the best reputation, but your breakfasts are out of control.
Sausages,
a stack of pancakes.
I don't have them every day. It's mostly just weekends. Okay. During the week, I suppose. But I'm just it's that whole social media thing of I'm just going, you know what, you've got to have a laugh on there as well. And yes, I am being the cliche of Instagramming food. But you know what? When I've got a really nice meal, it makes me happy. And other people like seeing it because they sort of go, wow, look at that. That looks like good food. You know, it's not everything on social media should be about, you know.
No.
Serious issues. It's like, let's just have a laugh as well. And let's just really enjoy food, because food is brilliant.
And guess what? Social media is about people expressing, not about entertaining others.
Yeah.
And if somebody doesn't like it, just hide it or move on. You know.
And also, I've got a lot of gay mates who are all, you know, oh, I don't do carbs. Oh, no, I've been to the gym today and I don't eat this. Oh, I couldn't eat that. And, you know, I'm eating a lettuce leaf for dinner. And I'm just like, ah, sod you. Here's my big fried breakfast.
We got plenty of those guys over here, too.
Yeah.
Of all orientations and everything. Well, and the other good news is, if you ever visit us down here in Southern California, I've got like five places that will fit right in with that to add to your food porn collection. We are just coming up on time. We'll do this again in January.
Because I've talked about two audios and that was it.
I know, it flies by. Brilliant. It's crazy. And also, I can hear the Torchwood fans sort of frumping, but.
Oh. We'll have to do another one. Talk about tortured then.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's leave with this. Yanto had to die, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
I don't get that. It's a tragedy. It's the tragedy of Captain Jack losing people. Of course.
Exactly. And also, indeed, it's also, I think, from although I wasn't involved with it at the time, it's also that thing of going. You know, that series had a lot of new viewers, and you know, the BBC One audience and stuff. Who haven't watched the BBC Three or BBC Two shows, you need to, you know, BBC One, you know, right from the first episode, or BBC Three, right from the first episode, it's showing members of Torchwood die. People don't survive till old age in Torchwood. So we saw that in Series 1, we saw it in Series 2. We needed to see it again in Series 3. And, you know, Yanto had to go.
How many Starks have to die before you realize this is a bad world? And it's and it's Captain Jack's tragedy. He's the doctor who's not prepared for it. He doesn't have the training and the experience and the tragedy that the doctor has.
Mm.
And he's seeing that, like, oh my God. Like he's the doctor who loves. This is what happened. Like David Tennant, when he says to Rose, you know, I can't spend the rest of my life with you. He knows that feeling. Jack doesn't. And he's learning it the hard way.
Exactly.
That's the story. I don't know. Sorry, the Yanto, save Yanto.
I mean, when I wrote my Tortured episode, you know, Yanto was one of my few scene, you know, was one of the few characters I could have a bit of humour with, because him and Owen weren't that close, so he was sort of having some humorous stuff in there as well. And he was a great actor to write for, because he was so, Gareth could play dry so well, and underplayed and that, and so you could write some quite sort of saucy stuff or funny stuff, and you'd know he'd underplay it, and it wouldn't seem out of sync with the rest of the episode.
Yeah, that's, and again, well, with the coffee scene, it's just, you know, showing him how to make coffee with such pride. This is like his Ferrari, his Porsche.
Owen can't make coffee.
And, but that's another one, though. One of the things, I actually just watched that this morning in preparation to familiarize myself. So that's another one where I just love, there's another lesson here for screenwriters, which is sometimes don't oversimplify, or sometimes don't overthink dialogue, you know, when Tosh... What's wrong with you? And Owen just says, I'm broke.
Oh, but I mean, I have to say, I learned a lot of that from Russell T. Davis.
Really?
He's just, he has changed how I write.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I owe him my big break in television anyway. But no, especially on that Tortured episode. But then on Sarah Jane as well. And it's a no, especially when I'm script editing the Dark Shadows audios, or a writer, a friend of mine will ask, hey, can you read this script I'm doing for something? Or, you know, or when I'm writing my own stuff, I will hear Russell's voice in my head going, oh, Joe, no, that's rubbish. And, and then, yeah, because he would tell you, he would say, no, you've written absolute tosh there. But then would make you realize why it was done like that. And you'd go out of a meeting thinking, this is the best thing in the world ever, because he has got you thinking along the right lines. He was so clever at that. And certainly in that Tortured episode, like you say, sort of sometimes less is more and things like that, a lot of that did come from Russell, because he was so good at just, he got the tone of it.
You know, Megan's a writer too. I'm always pointing that stuff out on TV, and because I love it, like, going to the Christmas Invasion, for example, or like, you know, again, in your Torchwood, I'm broken, Tosh, I don't work. Like, it doesn't have to be, never in my life have I felt such an inadequate.
Yeah.
No, yeah. Just, and like Rose, you know, could have said in Christmas Invasion, I've never been through an experience like this, I've never felt such a fear. No, instead she just says, look, I'm really scared and I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
That's all
it's
you need.
Human. It's human. It's about writing humans. And,
yeah.
You know, unless they're doing big podcast interviews like this, we don't talk in long speeches and sentences. You know, people interrupt each other. People hide the truth. People downplay the truth.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I think the Owens I'm broken line actually was mine. Thinking for me. But I imagine I probably added loads more and then Russell toned it down. Didn't tone it down. He suggested to me I tone it down.
Sure.
But the I'm broken thing, you know, that doesn't even begin to describe all the feelings that Owen is feeling. But in real life, somebody would describe all the feelings they're feeling.
But
and also the great thing I had there was I knew I was writing for Byrne Gorman.
I was just going to say, he brings it out.
Oh, I knew from the very first episode, I don't think I'd seen him in anything else other than Torchwood. And I knew from the first episode that he was something special as an actor, because I hated him in the first episode.
Huh.
And I thought, this is awful. Russell has written a character I don't like. Oh my God, Russell is my hero. Torchwood, I am absolutely adoring. But at the end of the first episode, I thought, I absolutely hate this Owen character. We're clearly meant to think he's this really cool, brilliant, oh wow, isn't he so cool and trendy guy? And then I realized in the second episode, no, we're not meant to think that. We're meant to see he is quite messed up. And what he goes through in the second episode directly relates to what he does in the first episode. And I just thought, oh. And then I saw it in that second episode. I just thought, well, Byrne did. And he did in later episodes. He's just such an amazing actor. I mean, that's why he's now the Jim Robinson from Neighbours. He's now in everything. He's Alan Dale. He's, you know, you can't switch on a film or TV show without seeing Byrne Gorman in it, because he's absolutely brilliant. You know, huge fan of his.
No argument for me. We're going to see him at the Gallifrey One convention, so I'll tell him.
Oh,
tell him we said hey.
Yeah, no, David. I would kill to write for him again. It was such an honour, and he was such a lovely bloke as well. Because it was my first telly, I was terrified, and we had the read through, and I, as soon as the read through finished, I ran out for a cigarette, absolutely terrified, because it was just like, oh my God, I've just heard these actors saying my lines, and it's going to get made as television. This is terrifying. And he came running after me and caught up with me in the corridor, and just wanted that and thanked me for the script. Sort of shook my hand and said thank you so much. And it was such a really nice thing for him to do. But I just think he's an amazing actor.
That is a great button. We ran a little long, and Joe, thank you for that great story.
That's right.
And thanks for everything, and thanks for being just so open and honest.
That's right.
About this stuff. This
having
is
a couple of glasses of wine.
I wish I was having one with you, but it's...
If it's going on any longer, you'd be getting all sorts of secrets.
Well, we'll save those for part two. I can't thank you enough. This was a real pleasure, and I hope everybody who's listening enjoyed it as much as I did. We'll see you for part two for Bloodlust.
Yes.
And more Torchwood.
And more Torchwood. Yes, because I did lots of Torchwood CDs and things as well, so there's loads I can talk about with Torchwood.
And we didn't even talk about Sherlock.
Oh, yeah. Sherlock blogs, yeah.
Don't tell Stephen Moffat or Mark Gatiss. We'll talk about them. We're saving them for the next time. So.
Hey.
Absolutely. Joe, thank you again so very much. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And, hey, if you like what you're hearing, please don't be afraid to share on Facebook, Twitter, anywhere on social media. So we will see you next week for Episode 8. Thanks for listening. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.